Welcome to the IF Podcast. I'm your host, Natalie Hopkinson, fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. Joining me in the Washington, D.C. studio is Sue Goodney-Lee, fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. Hi there, Sue.
Hey, how's it going?
And on the phone from Seattle, Washington is Kristen Rao Finkbeiner, Executive Director of MomsRising.org. Welcome.
Thank you.
So being that we have three smart moms on the line today, we've sort of dedicated this edition of the IF podcast to women and moms and family issues. Kristen, could you tell us a little bit about Moms Rising, how it came to be, and how you came to join the organization?
Moms Rising was started in May of 2006 with just a handful of members. And today, we now have over a million members nationwide, members from every state in the nation who are active on family economic security policies and who are really making a difference in helping both our children, our businesses, and our families thrive. We started after Joan Blades and I co-wrote a book called The Motherhood Manifesto, which looked at what steps are necessary in our nation to help actually increase family economic security and help mothers have equal pay for the equal work that they do. And after we wrote that book, we decided that the next step was to work for change, and we co-founded Moms Rising.
You know, just from reading the website, they have a very active online community at momsrising.org. If you all were here in the DC area recently, or your members were, what is the most recent activity have you guys had here in DC?
We had people at the White House during President Obama's job speech, really looking into how we can get families working, how we can have families be healthy, how we can help families thrive, and how we can help rebuild our nation's economy. 80% of American women have children by the time they are 44 years old, so the majority of women in our country are mothers. And Moms Rising, we like to say we're for mothers and anybody who's ever had a mother. So looking at family economic security in a time like now is absolutely critical. We have a crisis in families. The USDA reported that one in four children in America are experiencing food scarcity due to family economic limitations. And Moms Rising is fighting for solutions that both help businesses, help create jobs, and help children thrive.
And that actually provides a very good segue into one of our first topics, which is on The Help. The Help is a runaway hit movie, Hollywood adapted by the novel by Catherine Stockett.
These women raise white children. We love them and they love us, but they can't even use the toilets in our houses.
Minnie, are you in there?
You are fired!
These are Southern black women who raised many children throughout the South, and, you know, it was sort of a heartwarming movie that depicts that relationship between women, those who help and those who are helped, and a lot of the complicated tensions that arise in it.
It's striking to me that it was like this, you know, story about these black women that are told by a white person, and it has like kind of this paternalistic kind of flavor to it. And, you know, these workers are portrayed as really, you know, positive and they're doing good things. And, you know, these days, the upper middle class in this country use so much domestic labor that they probably want to imagine that they're these wonderful people who are good all the time. Or I remember when we hired our nanny, you know, her bag was sitting there and I smelled smoke and I'm like, oh my God, she smokes. And I'm like, well, you know, she doesn't smoke around my kid. You know, what do I really care? But, you know, you just have this idea of, you know, it's going to be Mary Poppins and, you
That's
know, they
right.
have these perfect backgrounds.
And not that they might have some complicated connections,
right.
You know, like the lives are not very tidy. And, you know, one of the things about that relationship is that you're looking at the people who are helped and those who are helping. You know, we're all women, all really struggling, all working mothers struggling to try to make it. And, you know, I know in my own life, it's always been a complicated relationship with those who have been helping. And I would think, Kristen, that in times when the economy is struggling so much and women are fighting to try to hold on to their jobs, that, you know, the issues related to the work done at the home is becomes quite politically fraught.
One of the things that we see is that right now, and this is one of the reasons why we started Moms Rising, is women without children make about 90 cents to a man's dollar. Women with children make about 73 cents to a man's dollar. Single moms make about 60 cents to a man's dollar, and women of color take an increased wage hit on top of that. There is significant discrimination still going on in our country, both against mothers and against others. And that really at Moms Rising, what we're looking to address is to help narrow those wage gaps, help end that discrimination. We also see discrimination in other recent studies. There was a study at Cornell University that happened quite recently, and they put out equal resumes of both moms and non-moms. When given the choice of an equal resume, the women with children were actually hired 100% less of the time than women without children. Mm-hmm. And for high-paid positions, they were offered $11,000 lower starting salaries, again, with equal resumes, whereas dads were offered $6,000 more than non-dads. So what we're looking at is we're really looking at what are the roots of those inequalities. Of course, there's outright discrimination, which needs cultural change and education. There's also policies and programs that we need to pass, which most other nations take for granted, that are shown to actually lower the wage gap in other areas. And those policies are some of Moms Rising's key areas that we work on. Policies like passing paid sick days, policies like access to affordable early learning so parents can work, policies like paid family leave. Those issues, including healthcare, really help lower the wage gaps and help all kinds of people be able to make enough money to put food on the table for their kids.
Many of these statistics can be found on Kristen's most recent blog post called Women's Equality Day, What the Heck Do I Tell My Daughter? What did you tell your daughter, Kristen?
I told my daughter the facts. Of course, she read the piece as well. She's 12 years old now. And I think one of the important things, again, is that this is a twofold area where we need to address the issues of discrimination. I agree that nobody is out there, well, hardly anybody is out there saying, hey, today's the day I'm going to discriminate against women and mothers. A lot of the discrimination is subconscious. A lot of the discrimination is the result of people thinking that we're still stuck in 1935 when the majority of families did not have two parents in the labor force. For this first time in history, last year, women comprised half of the paid labor force. But the issue is it's not just discrimination, it's also our public policy. So our public policies are stuck in 1935, and they haven't been caught up yet. So one of the things that we do at Moms Rising is we educate people about, hey, guess what? The majority of families need two parents in the labor force to make ends meet. And so because of that, we need public policies that reflect that, that make sure businesses and families can thrive. And we know that passing policies, I want to add, for moms, for women, actually raise all boats. You know, everybody mm-hmm. gets sick, for example. Not everybody has a chance to get better. Over 80% of low-wage workers don't have access to a single paid sick day. So when we're talking about passing things like paid sick days, we're talking about helping everyone. And we're really finding that in many of the policies, the business outcome is better, too. For example, in access to early learning, for every $1 taxpayer dollar in, there's usually about $7 out later in terms of less later grade repetition, less later experience with the juvenile justice system, and better outcomes for the kids in the long run.
Sue, you're getting ready to launch a project for the Interactivity Foundation on the future of childhood, mm-hmm. and wonder if you have any thoughts about this issue and how that might play in.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, I'll hear younger women say, oh, you know, I'm not a feminist. And I'm like, oh, you're not working yet. Because, you know, when you go out in the workforce, you know, I think with some of the disparities, men are still seen as somehow being the family provider. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh, well, they need to make more, you know. And if men have more seniority, like, oh, okay, that justifies a higher wage. But then if you have a couple women, you know, that are working somewhere, you know, other seniority level, you know, putting them at equal level, that's fine because, you know, they're just two women, whatever.
Right.
And so there really are, you know, some big challenges that remain. And I think when we talk about, you know, the future of childhood and we look at our kids and we imagine, what do we want to see for them? Mm-hmm. You know, you want to see something better. It's not like an individual, you know, man is like out to get us or something. It's just this system that kind of reproduces. And a lot of men have daughters. And when they have daughters, they're like, oh, well, I don't want my daughter treated like that. I'm like, really?
Well, and I think a lot of it is, you know, this is kind of a difficult word to use, but I mean, some of it is cultural. you know, women are very hesitant to ask. Mm-hmm. Men can be very bold and aggressive about these issues. These are very uncomfortable conversations to have. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, and if we look at a, you know, place like Sweden, for instance, you know, that has like something like all men, all women get like 80% paid leave days, you know, over the course of your child's life till they're 12 or something. It's made it a better situation for men and women. Companies aren't afraid to hire women because they're afraid they're going to leave or decide to stay at home with the kids because it's more cost effective, you know, or different things like that. So, you know, really, you're right. The policy level is where to address this.
And I think that this may be where the issue around domestic work sort of comes in. You know, as more women are in the workforce, there's still the same amount of dishes that need to be done, the same amount of laundry that has to be done, the same dusting, everything. And so for women, I think you're sometimes in the very difficult position of having to manage the household and wanting to get as much out of it as possible. You know, as mother to mother, you would love to be able to give all the vacation and sick time that you can. You know, it sort of ends up having this domino or ripple effect in your own life. And so, you know, we're sort of wearing two hats in a lot of cases. And sometimes that can be a very fraught relationship. I mean, those who are doing work in the home are entitled to the same, the mm-hmm. same sort of legal protections and consideration as those who are doing work outside of the home.
Work inside the home, work outside the home, all of that is work. Some of it's paid, some of it's unpaid. You know, there's a whole side discussion about unremunerated labor that many other countries talk about more than we do in the United States, which is unpaid labor. But I really think that it's important to acknowledge that anybody who is working inside the home, that is a very important job that deserves all of the same rights that any other job does. And Moms Rising definitely stands for that. And we regularly work with the Domestic Workers Alliance and others in supporting the rights of all workers.
Like to just segue a little bit into something a little bit lighter, and that is looking at the Real Housewives franchise.
My husband loves me and rent.
We're talking about work in the house, outside the house, and then, you know, the Hollywood treatment about this relationship between Black and white women in the South. You know, at the same time, we also have this explosion of interest in this reality TV Housewives franchise. I have to admit to not being the most avid viewer of the series, but it just seems like it's in the air so much. I wonder, what does it say about our society that so many viewers are tuned into the Housewives?
I guess it's kind of a distraction. They seem kind of glamorous, you know, in a time when the economy is rather not great. And, you know, so it's kind of a nice escapism. In these cases, these are, you know, the women are characterized as housewives and the men are working. And, you know, the women in some of the cases seem to have things that they're doing as well.
Oh, yeah. Some of them are working. Like, it's a bit of a misnomer because a lot of the women are working. Like, they're working as real estate agents and, you know, they're political fundraisers. The one in D.C. especially, I saw a little bit of. So they actually do have work, but there's still like this sort of, maybe it's a throwback thing around the housewives.
Yeah, there's like a bunch of them that seem to be these, you know, sort of gold digger type, yes. You know, like, I'm just going to find me a rich man and live off of him. And it's like, you know, I think that is, you know, A, insulting to women who actually, you know, are home taking care of kids and don't have a staff and, mm-hmm. you know, are doing like a lot of work. And I don't understand what women would want to just like, you know, find a man and live off of, like, that just seems so...
And unrealistic, you know? Because when I tried to get my husband to go along with that plan, he was just like, no, you got to go to work.
Well,
like,
that's
not going to happen.
I think one of the struggles that's happening in our culture right now is we do have a lot of television shows and things like that that really glorify the very wealthy in a way that is unhealthy and makes it seem like, oh my gosh, I'm the only one who's struggling. Look on the TV. Everybody else is, you know, dealing with all these issues relating to being very wealthy. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not experiencing that. And so what we have in our culture is a culture of rugged individualism. And what Moms Rising really does is we bring people together to share their stories and to say that when this many people are struggling with the same issues at the same time, we have a national structural issue and not an epidemic of personal failings. The issue of, you know, being able to even decide if you're going to have both parents in the labor force or not is not an issue that many families can even contemplate right now.
Absolutely.
Because they absolutely need the salary coming in from both. Going back to the statistic, which is just jaw-dropping, 1 in 4 kids in this nation experiencing food scarcity, right? I mean, that's huge. And that is just one statistic of many that show what's happening with American families. Having a baby right now is a leading cause of poverty spells. So the majority of families aren't able to contemplate, you know, whether or not they can have somebody, hire somebody to come in and help or not, and whether or not to be able to be in the labor force or not, and are really struggling with basic needs like food, health, and care, which is why things like access to affordable child care, access to health care, access to paid family leave becomes increasingly important in an economic downturn because too many families don't have that.
Thank you so much for joining us for the IF podcast.
Yeah, it was great talking
with you.
This is
Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner of MomsRising.org, where moms and people who love them go to change our world. Thank you for joining us, Kristen.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the Interactivity Foundation is a nonprofit organization that provides settings for the public to discuss issues related to public policy. And the next project that our fellow Sue Goodney Lee is going to be embarking on is the future of childhood. Could you talk a little bit about that and where you are in the process and what you hope to accomplish with this?
I have completed recruiting. I have 2 panels. Basically, you know, each of the panels is designed to meet and explore an area of concern. In this case, it's the future of childhood. And so, you know, what I'm hoping that they'll do is think about, you know, what childhood has been, you know, like in the past, most people think of their own childhoods. And, you know, there's something that happens where when you think back to when you were 10, everything seems idyllic and big
and
yeah, wonderful.
It's rosy.
And, you know, so, and then what childhoods are like now, which people are usually more critical about, you know, the current situation.
And it's all gone to hell.
And it was so great when I was 10.
Right.
And then, you know, to start thinking about, well, you know, what could childhood be? How could we imagine childhood in terms of public policy possibilities in a way that would allow a better outcome for a greater number of children, you know? So, I mean, children are kind of used for all kinds of selling of different kinds of policies and such, because who would want to hurt the children?
Right.
But often children do get hurt in public policy.
They do. They do. I mean, if there's a fight between seniors with Social Security and you know, the kids who are going to be seniors later, I mean, there's no contest.
Well, the seniors vote. And,
right. You know,
and the kids' parents are probably even too busy to go vote. So, yeah, you know, I'm hoping that people will, you know, sort of imagine some of the challenges that might face us in the future. And, you know, what could we do to reimagine the way that we do things in our society, you know, to make for better outcomes for more kids, you know, maybe, you know, things like changing the work options for their parents or, you know, different things like that. But when you start a panel like this, you don't know where they'll go.
So,
but hopefully they'll, you know, imagine some interesting things.
Can you tell us a little bit without, of course, these are anonymous panels that are meeting in the Maryland suburbs of D.C., actually the D.C. Baltimore suburbs, they'll be meeting. And there are 2 anonymous panels, but could you tell us a little bit about who they are and what range of folks you have participating?
Yeah. Some people have kids. Some people are, you know, have one person who's raising a niece, which a lot of people are in that sort of a situation in their families. And, you know, some of the folks have had really interesting childhoods. I have one panelist who, you know, his family left an African nation when there was political turmoil when he was really small. And they settled in Sweden. So he spent his first 10 years in Sweden, which was kind of an interesting experience. And then he moved to the States. So he has a very different view, you know, of childhood because, you know, he has different cultural experiences. Let's see, I have some, you know, teachers. I have people that work, you know, with juvenile detention, juvenile delinquents, people that have worked in early childcare. Trying to get the gamut of, you know, people that have had either direct personal experience and interesting childhoods or, you know, if one panelist who has no children, you know, to have that perspective. And then, you know, people that have done different things professionally where they've worked with young people.
That's good that you have that perspective because that's one thing that I think about. Even when Kristen mentioned that 80% of women will become mothers by age 44. 20% is a pretty large number. And so, you know, you wonder, you know, you do hear sometimes of people feeling like our policies are very child-centric or family-centric. You get tax credits being part of a traditional family unit. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's sort of a new emerging, our attitudes about what a family is evolving. Like even mm-hmm. I was at my daughter's back to school night and, you know, it's a new school that's starting and they are not calling the parents group PTA. They want to call it families group. And the principal was saying, we need to use that language, families, mm-hmm. because family can look a lot different than mom and dad mm-hmm. or even grandma and grandpa. It could be aunt, you know, mm-hmm. it could be a cousin, could be an older sister, mm-hmm. you know, or an older brother that's watching. And so, you know, our families are not this sort of neat, compact, you know, 2.5 kids statistical thing that mm-hmm. we've sort of treated it as both in public policy and in popular culture. One of the projects that the Interactivity Foundation has done is about the future of the family. And so we recently wrapped up that project and it's in the testing phase where many of the policy ideas are being thrown out there and discussed before the discussion document is printed out. And we actually have a wiki that anybody who's interested in contributing to some of the ideas about the future of the family is welcome to. And I will have that wiki is available on our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. This has been the IF podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. We enjoyed having Kristen Rao Finkbeiner on the phone from Seattle and having Sue Goodney-Lee here in the studio in Washington, D.C.
It was a pleasure.
Check us out on Facebook and online at interactivityfoundation.org.